advisement, and we now move to Billy Bob Teeth versus Novelty Incorporated.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lee Marshall, and I represent the appellant, Billy Bob Teeth, Inc., in this case. This is a copyright case involving costume teeth. Novelty, the defendant, sent Billy Bob's teeth to Taiwan and had them knocked off. Billy Bob brought a claim for copyright infringement and trade dress infringement, and the jury found that Novelty had infringed both. Now, we're up here on appeal today because over a year later, the district court granted Novelty's motion for judgment as a matter of law. In essence, the court found that Billy Bob Teeth didn't own the copyright in suit.
Do you think the implication of the court's finding was that there was no copyright, or that perhaps Mr. White or Mr. White and Dr. Bailey jointly owned the copyright, or where do you think this ruling left the copyright itself?
The district court simply found that the evidence that Jonah White had assigned the copyright to Billy Bob Teeth, he found that that evidence was not sufficiently reliable.
So do you infer from that he thought the copyright belonged at all times to Mr. White?
Well, Novelty also brought a motion for judgment as a matter of law with respect to whether or not Jonah White was the author or whether Dr. Bailey was also a co-author. And the district court, I believe, denied that motion as moot. The court didn't reach that.
But the reason I'm asking is one of the arguments you've made is that at the time the actual incorporation took place of Billy Bob Teeth Incorporated, which was in mid-96, as I recall, the assets that the partnership, or whatever we should call the more informal company that they've been operating, moved over into the corporation, right? And I want to know if one of those assets was, in effect, this copyright.
Well, Jonah White testified that the copyright was one of the assets that was transferred to the corporation. He testified that he and Dr. Bailey, who were the co-owners of the corporation, agreed to transfer everything that they were using in the business over to the corporation. In fact, he even testified that once we became incorporated, that everything, including the molds that were in place to make the copyrighted teeth, were transferred to Billy Bob Teeth Incorporated. So there was ample sufficient evidence to sustain the jury's verdict that Billy Bob, in fact, did own the copyright in suit here.
About the fact that there's the 204 issue? I take it that there's no hint in this record that there's some dispute between Jonah White and Dr. Bailey, or between either one of them and the corporation about this property, right?
No, there's absolutely no dispute. Dr. Bailey did not testify at trial. I don't believe he was deposed in the action.
Why didn't he testify?
Well, he's actually practicing dentistry in, I think it's South Dakota, and he just wasn't a witness we felt that we needed to bring in. So he did not testify, and he's no longer an owner of the corporation. He was in 96 when Billy Bob Teeth was incorporated, but he's no longer an owner, so he just wasn't involved in the case.
Was he an owner at the time litigation was involved?
No.
Was it 97 that he left?
Yes, that's right. So when the court held that Billy Bob's evidence was not sufficiently reliable, what the court was really doing there was making a credibility determination that he just didn't believe Jonah White's testimony. But on judgment as a matter of law, the district court simply can't do that. This court in Massey versus Blue Cross, 226 F3rd 972, has said that the jury is the body best equipped to judge the facts, weigh the evidence, determine credibility, and use its common sense to arrive at a reasoned decision. And that is what the jury did here. It makes perfect sense, perfect common sense, that when a small business owner incorporates, that he's going to transfer his assets to the corporation. And in fact, Jonah White testified to that effect. The conduct in this case is perfectly consistent with that. It was Billy Bob Teeth, Inc. that was marketing and selling these teeth, not Jonah White personally.
But I thought your opponents relied quite heavily on the fact that the actual copyright registrations, which I'm not putting my fingers on right now, are inaccurate, that they state that these copyrights are held by Billy Bob Teeth Incorporated as of a time that there was no such corporation. And I suppose one of the problems we have is whether that inaccuracy is enough to torpedo your entire case, which is what the district court fundamentally thought, and if not, why not?
No, the district court did not hold that the mistake on the registration was enough to torpedo the case. In fact, the district court characterized that argument as a complete red herring. The case law is very clear that inadvertent mistakes on a registration do not invalidate the registration. And that's all this was a mistake. There are several cases dealing with mistakes with regard to ownership on a registration. For example, in the 11th Circuit, the court has held that just mistakenly listing only one of two co-authors is not the type of mistake that's going to invalidate your registration. Now, Novelty has conceded that you can prove ownership either as a work made for hire or as an assignment. Now, Billy Bob introduced evidence on the assignment, and that the district court was not entitled to second-guess the jury's decision to believe that evidence.
That's this affidavit that you introduced during the trial?
Well, it's not only the affidavit, but it is also the testimonial evidence of the prior oral assignment, and it's the conduct evidence, which is all perfectly consistent with Jonah White's testimony. But without regard to all of the evidence that Billy Bob introduced on this, Novelty simply didn't have standing to assert this improper, what they believe was an improper transfer as a defense. Section 204 is a statute of fraud, and like any other statute of fraud, only party to the contract, or in this case the assignment, can argue that the contract or the assignment was unenforceable under that. Now, in Eden Toys, the Second Circuit held that when you have no dispute between the original author and the assignee, in this case between Jonah White and his company, Billy Bob Teeth, Inc., when you've got no dispute, it would be anomalous to permit a third-party infringer to invoke Section 204 against the assignee. And in fact,
well, they're basically at that point, if there really is a copyright, the third-party infringer would be getting a free ride on the mistake, right?
That's exactly right. And Section 204 simply was not designed to give a third-party infringer that kind of free ride. And in fact, Novelty conceded as much in its brief on page 2. They said, and I quote, "A defendant may only lack standing when the plaintiff has claimed ownership of the copyright by assignment from the author." That is exactly what Billy Bob is claiming in this case, ownership of the copyright by assignment from the author, Jonah White.
When was it first asserted? During the course of the trial or when the evidence was concluded?
The testimony was brought forward during the course of the trial, yes.
As to the ownership of the
As to the ownership of the copyright. It simply was not an issue in the case prior to trial. And at trial, Novelty brought in the fact that the corporation wasn't, in fact, yet incorporated at the time that the teeth were authored, that the design was authored. And at that point, Jonah White quite reasonably said, well, but I assigned it to the corporation when I incorporated. That was his entire point in incorporating, was to create a new business form and to use all the assets in the business in that form.
And it was a business, although not incorporated, before that. It was, what, a partnership, a sole proprietorship? What was it?
They were
using the name Billy Bob Teeth somehow.
They were. It was
that.
Certainly a going concern. I think it could be described as a joint venture between Dr. Bailey and Jonah White at that point.
Mm-hmm. So are you relying more on assignment or work for hire? Because as to work for hire, it's a little hard for me to think of Jonah White being his own employee.
No, we're relying entirely on assignment.
Okay.
In this case. That was the evidence at trial. That was the evidence that the jury was instructed on. That was the evidence that the jury found in favor of Billy Bob on.
There was no objection to the jury instructions on this point, were there?
No, I don't believe so. And if there was, it certainly has not been raised on appeal. There's, at the very least, a concession here on appeal that the jury was properly instructed as to ownership, and the jury, based on that proper instruction, found in favor of Billy Bob. Now, I want to also address the court's conditional grant of a new trial. The novelty has argued on appeal that that decision is entitled to deference here, but in fact, this court does not defer to errors of law. Both the judgment as a matter of law and the conditional grant of a new trial were predicated on the same reasoning, which included the district court's fundamental misunderstanding that Section 204 could be asserted as a defense here. And even the district court described its ruling as, quote, legal technicalities. Now, on that basis alone, we would suggest that the conditional grant of a new trial must also be reversed, that the two rulings stand or fall together. But even if there's an evidentiary dimension, this credibility aspect to the district court's decision when he chose not to believe Jonah White's testimony, even if that could somehow be disentangled from the court's legal reasoning, we would assert that the verdict was not against the clear weight of the evidence. In fact, when the district court chose to disbelieve Jonah White's testimony on the assignment, that contradicted this court's decision in Latino versus Kaiser, where this court held that you can only grant a new trial based on the court's disbelief of testimony where the testimony contradicts indisputable physical facts or laws. Jonah White's testimony is entirely consistent with common sense. He incorporated his business. He wanted to use the assets of the business in that corporation. That testimony certainly does not dispute indisputable physical facts or laws.
So, is there any issue? So you're arguing there is definitely a copyright for these designs, and I guess also the packaging, the trade dress. I don't know if you're going to go into the trade dress part of this, but I suppose looking at the photographs, it appears that there was in fact copying. Was that one of the things that you were, was the trial, were you expecting the trial to focus on that issue, the copying issue, or the access, or independent creation, or any of those others?
Well, quite frankly, we didn't know what to expect from novelty, because the copying evidence was so clear. And the confusion evidence was so clear. Frankly, we just expected novelty to try and minimize the damages at trial.
Which they did with the $500,000. Evidentiary ruling, right?
Which they did, and I would be glad to address that. The district court excluded that $500,000 pre-trial based on what it believed to be an untimely disclosure. But in fact, all the evidence related to these damages, and when I'm talking about these damages, I'm referring to the licensing deal that Greg O'Dell and Billy Bob Teeth were on the cusp of entering into. And Mr. O'Dell testified in an offer of proof at trial that but for novelties flooding the market with these knockoffs, he would have entered into this agreement and paid Billy Bob Teeth $500,000 in order to license the teeth.
When the district court called this untimely, did it make any reference to any schedules that it had established or any? Because you said in your brief that discovery had not yet closed.
That's correct. No.
What caused the district court to regard this? If you had to defend the district court, what would have caused him to think it was untimely?
I really can't answer that question. I just simply can't explain the district court's analysis here. Mr. O'Dell was disclosed as a witness having information about damages in August of 2000. January 2nd, 2001, Mr. Reedy, Billy Bob's expert, filed a report that contained a detailed description of these damages. Discovery didn't close for another month.
Did that report mention Mr. O'Dell's name? I mean, was there a way to link up the testimony of that, or the evidence about damages in that report with Mr. O'Dell?
I believe the report did mention Mr. O'Dell's name, but I'd have to check on that to be sure. We're talking about a full disclosure a month before the discovery deadline ends, 6 months before trial. Novelty had plenty of time to conduct discovery on this, but they chose not to depose Mr. O'Dell, they chose not to depose Mr. Reedy, they chose not to propound any additional interrogatories. Instead, they just moved to exclude the evidence, and they moved to exclude 5 days before the close of discovery.
Is there a remedy short of retrying the case limited to that $500,000 claim, if you're correct?
Well, we
if
would
you're correct that and when we agree that the judge should not have excluded that evidence, is there a remedy short of a new trial?
Well, we would certainly welcome this court entering judgment for Billy Bob for an additional $500,000. But no, Your Honor, I can't think of one. I think a jury would simply have to decide whether or not Billy Bob was entitled to those damages. I don't see an alternative remedy here. And I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Luters.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Luters. I represent Novelty, and I'm joined by former Judge Hamilton, the general counsel of Novelty. This case is about the word shall, and specifically whether a copyright owner can eradicate the word shall from the copyright statute and can eradicate the word shall from Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37C.
But it's not only about shall, if it's about standing, because there are all manner of violations of the law that might have occurred, but if the wrong person comes forward, they can't do anything about it.
That's one of their arguments, but even if they prevail on the standing...
How about that one? Just well, for starters.
That's right, and I will address that. We do have standing under Section 204.
Why should you be entitled, if we assume for the sake of argument that you infringe a copyright, and the only question is whether some entrepreneurs actually properly assigned their copyright to their new company, and there is no dispute about the fact that somebody owned the copyright, maybe Mr. White, maybe Billy Bob, why do you now get to manufacture as many copies as you want?
Three reasons. First of all, ownership is an element of their proof. So we're always entitled to defend against one of their elements of proof.
And
second,
they say one of them owned it. If it wasn't Billy Bob Keith, it was Mr. White.
Or Mr. Bailey.
Or Mr. Bailey.
That wasn't deposed by anybody.
Actually, he was deposed. That was an honest misstatement. He was deposed.
Was
it
testimony?
I don't recall the
trial.
I don't recall the content of it, and I
well,
don't
the,
think it
the
was.
The ownership issue wasn't. Nobody put that into evidence in the trial.
I believe you're right, and I just don't remember the substance of the deposition. But I know, in fact, he was deposed. But the second reason is.
But you agree then? Somebody, not you, owned this copyright. Either Billy Bob Keith Incorporated, Mr. White, or perhaps Mr. White and Dr. Bailey jointly, or perhaps Dr. Bailey, but not Novelty.
If there was a copyright, someone other than Novelty.
But there was a copyright.
Yes. We don't know, because we don't know what the copyright was. We don't know it was registered, because they never put into evidence or produced to us what supposedly was sent into the trademark office, excuse me, the copyright office.
Did you contest that there was actually a copyright registration?
There was a document, there was a registration that they agree is got at least four flaws in it, four material flaws.
Well, don't, never mind, I'll just read the record. I would like to know if there is in the record something that says it's a certificate of registration. There's
yes.
Something that's
clearly
refers
I mean,
to trial, you know,
Exhibit
71, and there are numbers, copyright certificate. I go to the website.
I misunderstood your question. Yes, there was a registration sent back from the Copyright Office.
Okay.
There were two of them, yes. There's no dispute as
so
to that.
So there's something that was registered by the Copyright Office with the photographs and the correct things that the Copyright Office wants, and I wonder what your response is to the authorities that Mr. Marshall was talking about that say mistakes in those documents, even if it's something as fundamental as the as a co-author, that strikes me as actually going to the heart of it. And if that's forgivable, why isn't mistaking the date of your incorporation forgivable?
That isn't forgivable. In fact, Seventh Circuit law, the Budget Cinema case and the Schiller case, suggests otherwise. Moreover, the other defects were the failure to identify the pre-existing works, which again, the Seventh Circuit has affirmed summary judgment of no cause of action for a plaintiff in a copyright case where the registration didn't identify the pre-existing works.
What do you mean pre-existing? So if I'm Shakespeare and I write Hamlet, I have, in order to get a copyright today, I have to refer to the books I read to get a copyright certificate?
Not if they're mere ideas that inspired the work, but if they're actually underlying works, which the testimony in this case was that the underlying works, allegedly as the story evolved, were from Dr. Bailey. And so whatever copyrights Mr. White might claim we infringe are merely the incremental addition.
You're arguing as though this is a patent case. This is a copyright case.
Well, it's well settled that a derivative work in a copyright case only affords the author protection on the incremental contribution of the derivative work. You can't then claim credit for the underlying work. So if you write a book, Harry Potter, and I make a Harry Potter movie, I might have a copyright on the Harry Potter movie derivation of the book, but I can't then pronounce myself also the copyright owner of the underlying Harry Potter book.
Let me get back to the point that novelty is out of the picture. I mean, the earlier work, it was perhaps owned by Dr. Bailey or by Mr. White or by their joint venture or their common law partnership, not you.
Yes.
How do you have any right to do this if we can exclude you as a legitimate owner?
Our position is this whole standing argument is ill-founded because it's a false analogy to a relativity of title thinking. If you have a chattel, the relativity of title doctrine says, well, if the plaintiff says they own it, you, defendant, who are accused of theft, can't challenge a third party. Copyrights are different. Copyrights are imbued with the public interest.
Copyrights are, as the Supreme Court recently said in the Eldred case, a form of property.
Clearly.
Copyrights can be owned, transferred, and you have to normally show that you have some interest in attacking the ownership.
That's right. And Thomas Jefferson recognized that copyrights and patents, the fundamental premise is that everyone is free to copy and use everything in the public domain, and the copyright laws and patent laws are an exception.
But you're arguing there's no copyright, basically. If there was no copyright, then this would all be in the public domain. You could make as many teeth as you wanted.
No, Your Honor. I don't know whether and what there was a copyright. There clearly was a copyright registration, but it's impossible to know what. So it's impossible to know what we're measuring my client's work against. And even if there was a copyright, case law says you've got to, they're very particular about the deposit materials to get a registration. The GeoScan case out of the Fifth Circuit refused a case because the plaintiff, even though they clearly came up with a computer program, couldn't find the original code. They could only find a second generation of the computer code, sent that deposit material in. There was no bad intent. There was no fraud. And yet they said no cause of action because you can only register. It's a very...
But, of course, copyrights as applied to computer software are a whole different animal than copyrights as applied to something like these teeth or like a play or like a movie. It's all under the copyright regime. But computer software is something imbued with some functionality as well. Not just ideas.
That's true, but I'm not making a functionality argument. If anything, the software is probably more entitled to copyright. Their alleged contribution, one of the works, was the addition of one chip in a tooth. That is pushing the outer limits of minimal originality. So if anything, the distinction between the software and this case is weaker. The failure to identify the pre-existing works in Budget Cinema was enough. The lack of deposit material makes it impossible to measure what exactly was allegedly copyrighted so the jury could measure, okay, what part did the copyright defendant take and what part was not part of the plaintiff's contribution.
It really seems to me like your argument here is quite different from what this case was about at the district court. I understood it to have been about ownership of the copyright at the district court. And now you're making a frontal assault on whether there's a copyright at all. And it seems to me a bit, well, different at least. And to raise something like that for the first time on appeal is troublesome.
It's not, it's in our briefs. It was raised below when we opposed the registration. And there's a distinction that's critical here. A copyright registration is not the same as the copyright.
Correct.
The registration.
You don't have to register at all. You can just put little C at the bottom of something you write.
That's exactly. You're exactly right. However, in order to march into federal court and have a sustainable federal cause of action for an injunction and damages, you have to get a registration, Section 411 of the copyright statute, and it has to be right. Section 409 of the copyright statute says shall. There are 10 requirements that shall be set forth in the copyright registration accurately. It doesn't, if you screw up the copyright registration, the piece of paperwork, it doesn't necessarily mean that the underlying copyright is invalidated. It just means your registration is no good, and without a good registration, you can't come into court and ask for money damages and an injunction. It is a formal requirement. It is a procedural requirement, but no different than if a plaintiff brought an appeal to this court and it, the court found out.
Well, then there's no copyright, in your view, without registration, because a copyright means nothing if you can't exclude others from copying.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
What is it? It's nothing. It's a decoration on the wall. It is not anything if it does not bring with it a right to exclude.
All I'm saying is you have to, before you come into court, follow the proper procedures.
You get certain presumptions if you follow the correct procedures. That's true.
Well, no. Actually, Section 411B says you have to have a proper registration or the court, the federal court, does not have jurisdiction. That's been held to be a jurisdictional prerequisite to having a copyright cause of action, even if you have the most wonderful, valid copyright in the world.
In federal court.
That's right. And it's immutable. And the court says, the statute says shall. You can't eradicate that. That doesn't mean maybe they couldn't.
And they have a registration.
But it's, they've admitted it's inaccurate. It doesn't.
The question is, does that, you know, if they accidentally typed 1997 instead of 1996 on it, as people do all the time in January of every year, that means that you have like a really strict construction rule here.
It is a strict construction rule.
So any typo, you put a comma instead of a period, invalid.
We don't need to decide that, but when you have four critical mistakes of they've admitted the author is wrong, they've admitted they didn't indicate
no,
how they
quite admitted the author is wrong. They're basically saying that there was a transition from one to the next and that the assignment could take place and could be verified with a later writing.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that's not correct. They've admitted, and it's undisputable, on the face of the copyright registration, it shows the author as being the corporation or the work for hire. That's an authorship status. And they've admitted that is incorrect. They have not gone back to the Copyright Office to correct this, which is available. There's a mechanism for correcting typographical errors, and it's in Section 408 of the statute. Congress contemplated this. They didn't do it. Instead, literally at the 11th hour, the night before the last day of trial, they typed up a nunk-pro-tunk assignment and sprung it on us at trial saying, oh, gee, you know, you're right, but we're going to toss this new document into the case, and it's Exhibit
like
70.
They sprung the registration of the corporation on them in the second day of trial?
We challenged ownership. I believe we challenged it when we filed the answer.
There was no objection to the jury instructions on ownership.
But there was an objection to the registration throughout the trial.
But the jury was properly instructed on what was necessary to find ownership.
Not precisely, because there was an objection, in part, yes, but there was an objection.
You didn't tender any alternative instructions.
There was an objection to the effective irrelevance of Dr. Bailey's contribution, that the judge wouldn't hear of us saying, wait a minute, you have to look at authorship because that dictates ownership. I mean, we're not in dispute that authorship and or assignment dictates who owns the Copyright Office. So we were cut off at the knees on that. Moreover, this 11th hour nunk-pro-tunk assignment has to be excluded. We objected. It was put into evidence over exclusion. Rule 37C of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, much like the $500,000 exclusion, says a court shall exclude documents and evidence that weren't produced before the close of discovery. This was the last day.
While you're on that point, what about the $500,000 claim, which seems to have been disclosed 5 months before the trial?
Your Honor, actually,
the last 11th hour.
No, it wasn't. In fact, there's been a misstatement of the record. In appendix, in the plaintiff's appendix, the reply brief. Hold on.
Well, you're looking for that. I'm going to point out to you that Rule 37C is not as unequivocal as you say. It's only if you have, if you are introducing it without substantial justification and you fail to disclose, then it's got to be excluded.
That is
correct.
Otherwise,
the court is permitted, if it wishes, to include. Substantial justification might be the fact that an issue didn't arise until the second day of trial, and so it wasn't anticipated. A district judge would certainly be within boundaries ruling.
You're correct as to the rules, but there was no evidence of substantial justification.
Yeah, sure there was. I mean, the judge didn't need evidence. It happened in front of his eyes.
But upon quiet reflection on the JMOL, he realized he shouldn't have allowed it to go to the jury based on that. On the date, the actual close of fact discovery was December 18th, 2001, even with the extension of time. December 18th, 2001. Then, after that, on January 2nd, 2002, the expert report arrived, identifying for the first time this new oral contract for $500,000 that supposedly my client caused them to lose.
Well, negotiations for it. It was an interference with the formation of a contract.
But the point being, fact discovery was closed December 18, 2001. In fact, that's acknowledged in their briefs. The only discovery that lingered was expert discovery, and that was the basis of the trial court's ruling on 37C. He said this $500,000 supposed fact was introduced after the close of fact discovery. Discovery was not open. It was only open with respect to expert discovery. Well, of course, experts only synthesize facts. They don't get to make up new facts along the way. This $500,000 oral contract sprung up after the case had been going on for 2 years. And their explanation was, well, gee, we forgot about that. You know, we forgot that this oral contract for $500,000 was all your fault that we lost. And the trial court exercised its discretion. At a minimum, it's an abuse of discretion standard. But I would submit, further than that, it would have been an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to exclude it, because it was after close of discovery. Rule 37C says you shall exclude it absent extenuating circumstances. There's no evidence of extenuating circumstances for their late disclosure of this yet again oral contract. I mean, this case is not only about shall, it's also about late submissions of supposed oral contracts after we have a chance to cross-examine and take meaningful discovery. I mean, like the non-proton assignment at the end of trial. I mean, he claimed that they had an oral agreement to assign the copyright, and the document also says the past causes of action for infringement. Does that sound like the sort of thing that an entrepreneur would actually have an oral discussion, or does that sound like
a discussion with himself? This is a little tiny company. It seems very plausible to me that a little tiny company that evolves doesn't quite keep up with the formalities, but they know perfectly well what their intention is to make sure that the assets flow to the company once it does get incorporated, and maybe they don't use precise legal terminology the way you would, but I don't see anything inconsistent at all about it.
If that's the legal standard, then the thought in your mind equals an oral contract, and that's an extension of oral contract law that I believe is unprecedented. Moreover,
well, how do you contract with a corporation? Is this a corporation? There's a person, right?
No, it's a legal entity. I mean, it's got representatives, obviously.
Precisely. And so the kind of conversation you're having is, in fact, that let's assume it's a simple case, a corporation with one shareholder, which can happen, of course. How does that person make a contract with his corporation?
In writing, precisely as required by Section 204 of the Copyright Statute.
And suppose he doesn't get around to doing it in writing, but all of the performance shows that those assets were held by the corporation. Letters, actions, manufacturing, et cetera. In other words, external indicia that there is, in fact, this arrangement.
If that were the case, and we do the operation of law approach, then all the same logic would say these copyrights went by operation of law to the partnership, the Bailey-White partnership that predated the corporation. And therefore, the copyrights that we're litigating actually reside in that partnership. Now, there was no writing, not even in Exhibit 71 on the eve of the end of trial, executing transfer of ownership from that corporation. They can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, common sense indicates operation of law conveyance of the copyrights from these individuals to their business, but never mind the first business. We only mean the second business because that way we win the lawsuit. It's inconsistent.
So if the both of them had been joined as plaintiffs in this action, you wouldn't have an argument to make?
We wouldn't have an argument as to the ownership, but the defects in the registration remain. The lack of deposit material, the lack of indicating who the author was, the lack of indicating how ownership was obtained, all required, predicated Section 409, those shall be in the copyright registration. It doesn't mean they're dead in the water. They just have to get the copyright registration correct as a procedural prerequisite. It's not difficult. It's a simple form to fill out, and the law allows you, if you go back to the Copyright Office, to fix it. But you can't come into a federal court after you drag a defendant through an entire trial and then say, well, gee, you know, they're just little typos. Never mind, that shall word in the statute passed by Congress doesn't really mean shall. You know, we can do whatever we want here. It's not hard, and these are important rights. These are federal copyrights. Patents and trademarks have rigorous requirements. There should be a rigorous standard.
So if we remanded for new trial on the $500,000, they'd have an opportunity to amend their pleadings?
They would have to actually go back to the Copyright Office, right, amend the registration. However, that would create other problems, statute of limitations problems for them, as well as the effective date of their registration would be the effective date of the corrected version, which, of course, is 5 years after publication, which would eradicate any presumption of anything. So timing does matter, and for good reason, because memories fade. I mean, the record indicated that what they were holding in front of the jury as being the teeth didn't have the same dimensions as what they told the Copyright Office they were sending in. So the undisputed evidence of record indicated that what they were telling the jury was copyright registered couldn't have been what they sent in the Copyright Office. We don't know what they sent in the Copyright Office, but they didn't dispute that there were a lot of different teeth designs floating around. So it's a shell game, and my client shouldn't be prejudiced by the fact that we don't know what was registered. It's an impossible standard to defend against.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time? 4 minutes.
Thank you. It's been difficult to figure out precisely what Novelty's argument is in this case. In their brief, they conceded that they didn't have standing. Now they seem to be arguing that they do have standing. In their brief on page 37, they conceded that a prior oral assignment may be subsequently confirmed in writing, including one that comes during the course of trial. Now they seem to be saying, well, it had to be done at the time. In their brief, they argued that, in fact, the copyright never transferred to the partnership on page 42. Now they seem to be arguing, well, that it transferred to the partnership and then it was never transferred from the partnership to the corporation. Even if it was transferred to the partnership, and they've cited some compelling Ninth Circuit law that says that it could not have been because there was no written partnership agreement, as a successor corporation, the Billy Bob Teeth Inc. would acquire the assets of the predecessor partnership, and there's some case law cited in our brief on that point. As to the registration itself, the registration is contained on page 83 of plaintiff's appendix. And it is true that there is a mistake as to the manner of ownership. It was not obtained by Billy Bob Teeth as a work for hire by Jonah White. But on pages 7 and 8 of our reply brief, we cite several cases holding that inadvertent mistakes, and this is a quote from Nimmer, a misstatement or error in the registration application, if unaccompanied by fraud, should neither invalidate the copyright nor render the registration certificate incapable of supporting an infringement action. And then there's a string of cases cited in our brief dealing with mistakes as to ownership. Those cases are directly on point and should not be overlooked here. Now, Novelty's now making a lot of noise about that this was a derivative work and that the registration wasn't properly introduced into evidence at trial or that there wasn't a deposit material. In fact, for a three-dimensional sculptural work, there is no deposit material requirement That's 37 CFR section 202.19C6. Billy Bob nevertheless submitted to the Copyright Office photographs of the work in suit attached to the registration. Those photographs clearly show the design of teeth at issue in this case with the chip in the proper place, the teeth configured exactly as they are in Novelty's knockoff version.
These are the photographs. The photographs in your brief are from the trial, or are they from the registration?
The photographs in our brief are from the actual physical teeth introduced into evidence at trial. I believe the full registration, including the photographs, are in the defendant's appendix. Now, Novelty's also arguing, well, this was a derivative work, and it's not somehow not entitled to as much protection, and that, and they even say that we didn't introduce the underlying registration. But in fact, the derivative work is identified on the back of the certificate of registration on page 84 of the appendix, and it refers to a sculpture and artwork in Novelty teeth. That registration was also introduced into evidence in trial, and there can be no dispute there. I see that I'm running out of time. If I could just finish one thought.
Well, you're not. Time's not up yet. So
as to the evidentiary issues. Novelty has not appealed the introduction into evidence of the nunk-pro-tunk assignment. They have not argued that it was an abuse of discretion. There's nothing in their briefs on that. And they also have not argued on appeal that any of the jury instructions were improper. All of those arguments are waived on appeal.
Would you address the discovery issue that Judge Evans inquired about, the $500,000?
Yes, the judge's order on exactly how far the discovery was extended is a little bit ambiguous. I think it's a fair reading to say that fact discovery closed on December 18th and expert discovery closed at the end of January. But Mr. Odell, who is the fact witness, was disclosed prior to the close of fact discovery. Mr. Reedy, the expert, was disclosed with a report.
What does report with the $500,000 that was lost?
Yes. His report contained information about the $500,000 lost licensing opportunity.
That was disclosed prior to the December 18th cutoff?
No, the expert report was disclosed during expert discovery. But they could have obtained ample discovery. We were still 6 months before trial. If they needed to go depose Mr. Odell at that point, even though he was disclosed way back in August, they could have asked the district court permission to do that. They didn't do it, and we would submit that the district court abused its discretion in excluding this evidence without any showing of harm or prejudice to Novelty.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Go to the third case for today, which is United States.